Welcome into this video. If you're watching on YouTube or if you're listening on a podcast platform, welcome into that. So this is actually my second attempt at doing this book review. The first attempt didn't go so well. As I was going to edit it, it sounded like I was running through a forest full of leaves. So all you can hear is constant rustling. So that was a no-go. I was like, I can't put this out to the public. It just doesn't sound good. So we're restarting and gonna, you know, I'm actually kind of glad I'm restarting. I think I could do a better job this time around than the first time around for this particular book that I'm talking about. But without further ado, I appreciate all the new viewers, all the returning viewers or listeners. You guys mean a lot to me. So I just want to kind of jump right into this thing and tell you about this book I recently finished. I actually should have it in front of me. That's what I should do. I should go get that book. So if you're watching this on YouTube, this is the book I recently finished. If you're listening on podcasts, it's called The Forgotten Highlander. It's by Alistair Urquhart. I don't know if I pronounced his last name right, but I'm going to go with that. So that's the book I just recently read. Let me tell you, I haven't read a book this quickly in years. I was absolutely in the zone with this book. It was something I just couldn't put down. It's something I haven't felt that way about a book in quite some time. So that tells you how great of a book this is, how great of a story it is, and just how fascinating this whole situation was for this particular individual. So the premise of the book is based in World War II, and it's about survival in the Pacific, so the Pacific Ocean. So this whole, the premise of this podcast episode or YouTube video, whatever you want to call it, I'm going to go into key parts of the book. And I think there's a general theme throughout the whole book that I hope you guys take away, which is the thing I took away when I was reading it. And I always kept going back to these couple traits. The things that kept popping into my mind was just gratitude, perspective. And that those are the two biggest takeaways I took from this book. Like, you'll see as we dive deep into this thing, like how those traits are something I think about constantly when reading this, and something I think you would think about as well if you read the story. It's simply a story I will never forget. I think I will think about this at least once a day for the rest of my life. Just if I'm having a tough day, if something's not going my way, I think I might go back to this book and just think about, like, okay, so that person went through all of that, and I'm complaining about this small situation, this small problem I'm having. Yeah, no. And then I mean, it's already worked where I go get back into the zone, and it's like, you know, this situation's just not a big deal compared to that situation. So we're going to take this in stride, and it could be a lot worse. I will say, I don't know how a human being can survive what this person went through, what Alistair went through back in those 80 years ago, whatever it was. It's simply just a true test of character and will to survive. And I was thinking when I was reading the book, it's like, would I be able to survive the same exact situation? Would I be mentally tough enough to do that? That's what I kept going back to. And it's like, I will never know because I will never be in that situation in my entire life. So I can't really give you a firm answer. I can't give myself a firm answer on that question. But it was something to ponder and think about. And if the answer was no, then it's like, how can I get mentally stronger so I could survive that situation if it happened in my life, or if I had to live that situation in my life at some point in time? So the premise of the book, Alistair was a normal person. He was 19, I think, when the book started. Lived in Scotland, Aberdeen, Scotland, with his parents. And this was the start of World War II, just when it was starting, basically. He ended up getting drafted into the army, I believe, by Britain, Great Britain. And so he had to go to boot camp and so on and so forth. And then he got shipped off. He had no idea where he was going. And then he got shipped off to Singapore. So back then, Singapore was controlled by the British. And once he got to Singapore, he kind of settled in, met all of his, you know, fellow army members or military members, got to know his commanding officers. And pretty quickly, he was realizing that they weren't really prepared for war. They weren't prepared to go into battle. Their officers weren't prepared for much of anything. One of the things that really sticks out to me was the fact that their commanding officers would have them take naps in the afternoon. I think from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. like every day, because they're in the tropical heat and they're taking naps to rest up. And he was thinking, like, I don't think our invaders are taking naps in the afternoon. So he was concerned. That was like his first major red flag for him, was like, we're not prepared if we get attacked. We're not prepared if we have to go into battle because we're taking naps every afternoon for 2 hours. Like, our enemies are not taking naps. So that was his first, like, okay, this doesn't seem right moment. So as it goes on, everyone was very lackadaisical and just kind of had the feeling that they would never actually truly go into battle or get invaded. So that was kind of the feeling amongst many people in the island or peninsula. I think Singapore is in a peninsula. They were truly not ready for really any combat. They weren't preparing, training that hard for combat. What I got from what he was talking about was it just felt like they were going with the flow and they thought they would never be called upon to actually participate in the war. So, but then the unlucky day happened. Their base and Singapore in general got attacked by the Japanese. And the next thing you know, they are attacking by air, and ground troops eventually got to him a couple months later. Got to Alistair a couple months later at Fort Canning. And then they took everyone prisoner. So they took them prisoner and took them to another part of the peninsula. It was already kind of like a fort before. And they started using that as a prison. So there's thousands and thousands of prisoners, British, Australian, Scottish people that were taken prisoner. And so he was there for a couple months. And then this is when everything truly starts going downhill for Alistair. He was selected to join a holiday camp and get transported to a holiday camp by the Japanese. And so they rounded everyone up outside that was going to this holiday camp. And everyone was very excited but him. The Japanese officers were saying, you're gonna go to this camp, you're gonna work 3-4 days a week, you get 3-4 days off a week. It's gonna be very, you know, laid back. You guys can get a lot of rest. You're gonna have you basically won't be prisoners. You'll be like well fed, all that fun stuff. And mostly everyone else that was going with them was very excited about this. They believed every word these Japanese officers were saying. And so they felt very good about themselves. They thought they were catching a break, being in that type of prison environment. So like, yeah, this is gonna be like a vacation for us, basically. If we're gonna be prisoners of war, I was like, I'm glad it's gonna be this type of prisoner of war. But Alistair didn't believe a word the Japanese officers were saying. He's like, that's way too good to be true. And so eventually, or shortly after, the Japanese officers and, you know, their underlings put all these prisoners onto a train cart. So they packed them into this train cart, very minimal space, standing room only, and they got transported. Had no idea exactly where they were going. I think it was about 5 days of them being in this train cart, very minimal stopping, or when they did stop, they could go outside for 20, 30 minutes, and that was about it. So everyone's, as you can imagine, jam-packed in this train cart. You can't lay down, you can't really sleep, it's tough to sleep. And there's no minimal ventilation. So at this point in time, you know, people are relieving themselves right where they stand, and it's just a horrifying environment for these individuals. And that then at that point, no one believed they were going to a holiday camp and they're going to go on like a vacation, basically. They knew that they were, you know, lied to and that their life was going to be hell from that point forward. So that was that whole situation. And they were just begging for any type of fresh air because they're just in this box car in 110 degree heat or humidity. And it smells were something you never want to smell. That's what he described it as. It was just a horrifying and terrible experience. And that was not even the worst of it. So eventually they stopped, they got out of the train car, and then they were told that they have to walk 150 kilometers to the camp that they have to go to on foot. So they had to walk 150 kilometers, I think in another 5-day period, to get to where they were going. Minimal food, minimal water. Doesn't matter if you're sick, you still gotta go. It doesn't matter if you have a broken bone, you still gotta walk. They were, if you weren't, then you were, you know, put down or whatever they did to you. And at this point, people started dropping like flies on prisoners. They just were dehydrated and starving, and they started getting sick and whatnot. And it just, so Alistair had himself at the front of the line, so he couldn't see anyone else behind him, you know, dying and whatnot. Because if he saw that, then that would have an effect on his mentality, and he might succumb to that thinking as well and not make it to his destination. So eventually he made it to the camp, and it was just like they were instructed that they had to build their own huts and sleeping quarters. So they had to do everything from scratch with a couple different tools and whatnot, and they weren't told how to build. They weren't told how to build these huts and whatnot. They had to just do it on a limb and wing it. And so they eventually got them built and whatnot over the course of a couple days, I think. And then the real work started. So he was transported to this camp where they had to work on something called, the Death Railway. So right off the bat, based off that title, you probably thinking that that's not a good title. That is not a good name for a railway. And the reason why it was called the Death Railway is because a lot of people died trying to build this Death Railway in the middle of a jungle. However, so his life for the next couple of years was him working 18 hours a day with a couple handfuls of rice a day, minimal water. That was it. That was the only food he had for years, a couple years. Only water he had for a couple years. So he was surviving off 700 calories a day. Obviously with the rice being plain old rice, no taste to it. There's no nutritious benefits to this rice whatsoever. So he was, his vitamins, he had extreme vitamin deficiency after a short while. And it got to the point where his stomach lining was non-existent because he had no vitamins in his body anymore because he was just eating plain rice. And at that point in time, his health deteriorated, became a living skeleton, and yet he still had to work on this railway every single day, 18 hours a day. Doesn't matter if you have malaria, doesn't matter if you have cholera, doesn't matter if you have any of those diseases. If you were able to somewhat walk and function, you had to work. You have no choice. If you didn't work, then worse things were going to happen to you. So that was his life for 750 days, I think, working on this railway, and then eventually a bridge in the same type of area. And they had to build this entire railway from scratch with minimal tools, and they had to chip away at these big boulders by themselves. And mind you, like I said, they had very minimal vitamins and nutrition, so they were losing strength and whatnot, and they still were forced to work on this railway every single day. Doesn't matter if they had no strength left. If they were basically living, they were working. And so he was trying to do everything he possibly could to do as little as he could in those 18 hours a day. He was making it look like he was working a lot, But in reality, sometimes he was doing the bare minimum with the Japanese not recognizing that he's not doing much of anything, because he has to conserve his energy as much as he possibly could. Because if he, you know, passed away working on the railway, the Japanese officers are just going to bring someone else to replace him. So they were very dispensable. They just had an unlimited amount of individuals to replace these workers if something happened to them. So these Japanese, you know, military members didn't care what happened to these people, because they could just be replaced. So as long as they were functioning, they're going to use them for their forced physical labor, and use them they did. And he mentioned that basically every single prisoner had developed something called tropical ulcers. Now, I didn't look this up. I don't want to look it up. I've been warned not to look it up because I heard it's absolutely disgusting. So it's something that eats away at the flesh on the skin, and it sounds like it's absolutely horrifying. So graphic viewer discretion advised. But that's something they had to live with as well, and they had to work through that. I just don't know how a human being can go through something like that. You have to be the strongest type of person to get through all of these different things. I don't know how you work 18 hours a day. You barely get through the day, and you're living with malaria or any of these tropical diseases that he ended up developing. And you're living off 700 calories of plain rice a day with no vitamin benefits whatsoever. And you have to go to sleep after work, and you have to think there and sit and think to yourself, like, I have to wake up and do this thing all over again. Like, I don't know if I have the strength to wake up, but yet I'm going to be forced to go work on this thing for another 18 hours if I'm able to wake up and able to be somewhat competent. He had to do that every day. That was his mindset every day. His mindset was just get through this day. That's it. That's all I'm asking. And then we'll worry about the next day. And that's how he got through that entire situation. So as you can imagine, so at that point in the story, I started thinking what I told you earlier, is like, would I be able to survive something like that? Would I be mentally strong enough to go through something like that? And I didn't know the answer, because I had never been in a situation remotely close to anything like that before. I'm sure none of you have been in a situation like that before. Being under the threat of death every single day, you're always being watched by these soldiers. You're always under the threat of getting beat every single day. If you do one wrong thing, you might get beat to hell and then be forced to work after. Because he got beat many, many times by these commanding officers. And it didn't matter if he had broken bones or losing teeth and had nerve damage, had to get right back up and get back to work on this railway. It's just mind-boggling what some human beings have gone through and what other human beings have put human beings through. It's shocking to say the least, and I just don't understand it. And at this point in the story, this is where I started getting my gratitude and my perspective of the whole situation. It started making me think, like, I am very grateful for the situation I'm in. I live a freaking comfy life. I live a luxurious life compared to what these prisoners went through. My life, my problems are not even problems to these people. My problems would be more than accepted by these people. Let's say hypothetically, if I made $500,000 and I ended up losing everything, I lost all my money, my bank account got drained, something like that happened, they would take that problem over this any day of the week. Like, I can guarantee that. So that's what they would go through any problem, basically, other than that. They would rather have anything else in that situation. And mind you, I forgot to tell you, they were working in the tropical heat, in the sun every single day, basically fully unclothed. They had like one little piece of clothing. And that was it. That was their life for 750-ish days, with this one little cloth of clothing. And eventually they got to the point where they had no more shoes, because their shoes were just worn off and just weren't effective anymore. And they had to work without shoes. And So you're working in the, let's just say 110 degree heat, humid, in the jungle, middle of the jungle, sun beaming down on you every single day for 18 hours, every single day. That's your life right there. How do you survive that? How do you survive something like that? And then he mentioned monsoon season rolled around in that side of the world. And there was quite a big storm one time. I think it was in June at some point. And they got to the point where, so they all had to go bathroom in like the same spot, basically. There was obviously no toilets, no restrooms, nothing like that. So they all had to go bathroom in the same spot. And this monsoon, I guess like floodwaters or whatever it was, washed all their human waste away and made everything airborne, if I'm remembering that correctly. And that at that point in time, that's when a cholera outbreak happened, was when this happened, when that monsoon hit. And so many people in the camp ended up getting cholera, and a lot of them were passing away within hours of contracting the disease. And Alistair ended up getting cholera, and he didn't think he was gonna make it, obviously. And somehow he pulled through, and he still had to work. He still had to work through that. I think he had like some time off to recover, but it wasn't much. So after the bridge, so he got shipped off to like, I think a little further north to this, or after the railway, he got shipped off to work on this bridge. And he had to work at that same type of working conditions, all that fun stuff, for quite a while as well. And then after that, he got sent to a hospital to recover for a little bit. And so I think he was there for like 6 months, at this hospital for 6 months. He saw some of his former people that he was prisoners with before he got sent off to the railway. And he was able to connect with them and kind of recover. And at this point in time, he couldn't really eat real food because his stomach lining is shot. It was irreparable. So his diet was forever changed. Like, he could never eat any of the same foods he ate before anymore. And he'd incorporate rice into his diet, I think 3-4 days a week after he got back from being a prisoner, because his body was just so used to the rice, and he could only eat a handful of things the rest of his life, which is just absolutely so sad. So after this hospital, he ended up getting shipped off into another part. He ended up getting shipped off to somewhere else. And so the Japanese packed them into the hull of a ship. And again, it's standing room only. This time I think there's even less room in the ship than there was before. And he couldn't, obviously, he didn't have the choice to sit, didn't have the choice to lay down. You basically just stood where you stood for, I think it was another 5-day period. And this time around, there was no food. There was no water. They dropped, I think, like food through like this one little hole down into where they were, and they had to fight over getting this food. And I think he got lucky enough where he was able to get a thing of rice that had like water in it. So that was that for basically 5 days. And you know, this is when it gets really, really dark here. So like I said, they're in this just pitch black hole on a ship, crammed together, no idea what's going on, no food basically, no water. They're there for days. It got to the point where people were driven to insanity. And some of these people ended up, they started to go after each other because they, survival instincts, their survival instincts kicked in, and they had to do whatever they had to do to survive. And so people were started, you know, killing each other. And then, I hate saying this stuff, but you know, I think it's very important for the book. Cannibalism became a thing. and he's just stuck there. There's nothing he can do. And at that point in time, he's trying not to go insane himself and just trying to think about anything else. And people dying all around him from dehydration, starvation. And you're hearing these people getting attacked and whatnot. And, you know, luckily no one around you, around his general area, is going after you. It's just that is, I can't even imagine that. I literally cannot imagine that whatsoever. It's disturbing. And again, I don't know how a human being can go through something like that and be fine after. I don't know how other human beings could put more human beings through that situation, knowing that that's what they're going through. It was shocking when I first read it, and just gratitude popped up again. Just very grateful for my problems. It's just an unbelievable story, honestly, and I think you're catching on to that, so I highly recommend you read this book. All right, we're gonna be wrapping up soon. So he's still in the ship, okay? And then at one point in time, the ship they were on, which they called Hell Ships, I think it's a fitting name for that ship, they ended up getting torpedoed by an American submarine. So most of the people on board, most of the prisoners on board, died in the middle of the ocean. But Alistair, as you guessed, survived, because it wouldn't be a book without him. Excuse me. He ended up surviving that. So he was stranded in the middle of the ocean for, I think it was another 5-day period. And on the ship, obviously minimal food, minimal water, basically no food and no water. And now he's stranded in the middle of the ocean with no food and no water for 5 days. Tropical sun, no land in sight. At that point in time, he's just thinking, this is it. He eventually found like this piece of wood of some kind that he used as a raft, and he just floated on that for those days and days. And dehydration is catching up to him. He's hallucinating many different things, and he was very, very close to death in the situation. And then he saw someone approaching him, and it was a Japanese individual. I don't know. I forget if it was like they were someone in the military. They had to have been. Why else would they be in the middle of the ocean? They ended up giving him some chocolate, this person. And he's had no food for so long. He hasn't had anything other than rice in years. So he had the restraint to not eat the chocolate, because he knew if he ate that chocolate, his level of thirst would increase dramatically. And that would be the end of him. So he ended up taking that chocolate and throwing it in the ocean. Even in that situation, I don't know how your brain doesn't take over and just doesn't think about any of those situations. And you just have a chocolate because you're just so desperate to have food in you. But he didn't. He prevailed, and he did not eat that. So then eventually he got picked up by, you guessed it, a Japanese ship. So they ended up taking him to mainland Japan, where he had to work in this mine, I think. He had to work in a mine, yep. And I should mention, at the start of the war, or back when he was in boot camp, I think he was 135 pounds. By this point, he's 82 pounds. He's a living skeleton, because his diet, 700 calories a day, he's probably burning tens of thousands of calories a day working on that railway and then that bridge. I don't know how anyone survives something like that. When they're consuming 700 calories a day, but they're expending tens of thousands of calories a day, like, how does that work? Unbelievable. So he got stationed, or he was sent to a mine right outside Nagasaki back in 1945, August 1945, or before then, actually. So I think he worked at this mine for a couple months. And then the Americans dropped the atomic bomb on Nagasaki. So he was a little outside Nagasaki, but he felt the effects of the blast from the bomb. He got blown to his... He got blown on his back, or whatever it was, from the shock wave. And he has no idea what just happened. He's like, what was that? And so he felt the blast. And shortly thereafter, the Americans that ended up finding him and all the prisoners, and they're just shocked to see what they saw. They saw these individuals that are living skeletons as prisoners. And I can imagine being an American soldier and then seeing that. It's like, oh my goodness. So obviously it was a very long recovery for Alistair. He was never the same. He was never the same the rest of his life. I already mentioned his diet was forever changed. He couldn't eat pretty much anything other than a couple of things. He had PTSD for obvious reasons. He would go to bed, he would think about his tormentors, think about everything he went through basically every single night. So he never looked forward to sleep. He never did. He never looked forward to putting his head on the pillow and going to sleep. Because those were the images he saw a lot of the time. Seeing the faces of the people that beat him and the faces of the people that were just made his life a living hell. I can't even imagine that. He ended up getting married and having children, which was awesome to see. But he had to sleep separately from his wife because he was afraid he would choke her in his sleep because he would have nightmares. Some of the diseases kept coming back and popping up here and there throughout his life. And he eventually developed skin cancer, which is probably a direct result of working in the tropical sun heat every single day for 18 hours with like no clothing. But he ended up surviving. He ended up passing away in 2016. So he lived until he was, I think, 93 or 94, which was fantastic that he lived such a long life after that. So that was great to see, but it's just knowing the fact that he had to go through all that and live like that the rest of his life is just truly devastating and made me realize just how good I have it in my life and how lucky I am for my problems. And it was truly an eye-opening book, and I hope this little review of the book and the whole situation, I hope you took away that the two main points of this book is gratitude and perspective. I don't think there's anything else that truly comes close to those two traits from this book. It's just you take what he was talking about in the story and you relate it to your life and you think, have I gone through anything remotely close to what he's gone or he went through in his life? And, you know, I challenge you to think back to the situation whenever you're going through something that seems very difficult and it seems like you're just not going to see the other side or seems like everything's crashing down around you. I challenge you to think about what he went through and what these people went through back in that day and just ground yourself back in the present moment. Be like, okay, is my situation worse than what he went through or what those people went through? So I challenge you to do that. I challenge you to read this book. I can't recommend this book enough. I will probably put a link in the description to this book so you can find it on Amazon. But 10 out of 10. This book is a 10 out of 10. And I don't put that lightly. I think it's just something truly unforgettable. Like I mentioned earlier in the video or podcast, it's something I will forever remember and always think about the rest of my life. And I most definitely read this again a couple more times. So that's that. It's a kind of a somber video or podcast episode, but I think it's an important one. So I appreciate all of you that watched or listened to this episode. It truly means very much to me. Thank you to all the new viewers, the returning or the older viewers. I appreciate every single one of you. And yeah, so like, subscribe to the video. Follow my podcast on any podcast platform that you listen to on. And you got all my links in the description to my social medias and whatnot. So again, I appreciate every single one of you. And I truly hope you pick up this book one day and read through it because I think it's such a truly important story that I think more people should know about. So you can use that in your own life and become more mentally strong in your situations because your problems aren't problems to someone like Alistair. That's the moral of the story. So I appreciate all of you, and I will see you in the next video.